16th, I think.
16th.
We're interviewing in his office in Helen White in the Center for Development, and I'm Laura Smail. We're going to be talking mostly about the economics department today. I know you just came here in 1945, but you must have heard about the Milton Friedman incident a good deal.
Not a good deal, but I heard some things. It was alleged by the people I heard from that, or they said that Friedman would have stayed here except for Walter Morton, who made it very unpleasant for him and he left. But that's the only thing I've heard. But I don't know any details of it.
That's another chalk mark against Morton, isn't it? So you don't think it was... I've heard various reasons.
Well, what that, have you heard? Maybe?
Well, somebody said something about anti-Semitism.
Well, they had... Sally Perlman was a member of the department.
Yes, that's right. So that doesn't seem to
well,
make
and
sense.
Elizabeth Brandeis was a member of the department.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed around over the years is often when a Jewish person is involved, whatever comes up, somebody starts charging anti-Semitism.
Uh-huh.
Now, there may be some of that, but in the department, I recruited Peter Steiner and Martin Bronfenbrenner and a lot of Jewish people. We never had any anti-Semitism. I suspect one or two people had some remnants of that in their system, but by and large, it was not. They wouldn't dare to voice it very loudly.
Mm.
They might in their decision making. They might, but I don't really. I think it's more probably personalities. Morton is a very strange person.
He was already then strange, was he?
He was one of the stories that I heard about the early years, that when he came up for tenure, this of course is all hearsay and a long time ago, there was a real question about his personality and how what he would be like to live with for all these years. At that time, his own professor, I think it was Scott, made a big speech. Well, you know, what we want here is brilliance, and you're just being personal about this, and carried it over.
Mm.
It was that kind of a situation. And again, this is all hearsay, you understand, and
yeah.
I don't, it's not the sort of thing that I would have any reason to check on or anything, but that's what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one person alive who might know something, might remember something about that, and that would be Elizabeth Grant. Who is it? Bill?
Yeah.
Get some coffee.
Yeah.
I didn't realize Jim Early was here that long, but I guess he was here in the 30s, wasn't he?
In the late 30s,
He was in the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So Morton, it wasn't a case of deteriorating personality.
Well, I don't think so. I think it was it existed from the beginning. At least, if there's any truth to this, what I heard,
yeah.
And he was it was in full steam when I arrived in 1945, I recall going into the office to ask to see the chairman, whom I thought was Mr. Groves, and then discovered that because of the Walter Morton's collusion with Evu about calling Groves selling out, that Mr. Groves was no longer chairman.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. It was that Morton got him out of the chairmanship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know Groves has written an autobiography.
I haven't seen it.
Well, I was lucky enough. I was looking in our... We have a sort of little public newspaper file, but it was thick and it had about 200-page biography that he'd written, autobiography. And he talks about that.
Yes.
That incident.
Well, you see, what he had done is it accepted a grant from the Committee for Educational Development for research. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a very progressive group, and so, but Morton, again, was very close to Bill Evu. Mm-hmm. Whenever there was anything in the university, he'd leak it to
That's strange,
Evu.
Isn't it?
Strange.
I would have thought Morton was a very conservative man.
Not necessarily, no. Sometimes, yes. His brother-in-law was
Can I turn this off?
Yes. Was Amley, let me just pull the plug. Was Amley, you know, the progressive leftist congressman.
Oh, I didn't.
Yes, you see. There's a complicated, lots of complications. See, Morton sometimes is on the liberal side and sometimes on the conservative side. Only in his later years did he stay on one side, and when it became profitable for his consulting business and so on.
And liberal would have to do with attitudes toward business and labor as well.
Yes, you know. Yes.
So that must have been confusing for Elwell, I suppose.
For Evu?
No, I was thinking of Elwell.
Oh, Elwell, yes. Well, yes, Elwell would never have, I don't think, might have worked with Morton when it was convenient to, but they would never have trusted each other.
I see. Because you get the impression that, from looking at the files, that Elwell and Morton are on the same, even though Elwell says he would never have Morton teaching in the... He wanted the department, but not Morton, I guess.
Yeah.
Is that...
Well, I don't know, but I'd understand that. See, Elwell would have used Morton when he could, and Morton vice versa. They would use each other.
Oh.
But Elwell wouldn't, as you... I didn't know about this particular thing, you see. I haven't dug into the files, so
yeah.
I don't know these past things, but... But that would be my guess. As I say, when 45, now, one of the interesting things about this in fighting in the department, where, and by that time, Groves and Morton were on separate sides, quite separate, divided. None of that, to my knowledge, ever affected the career of a graduate student. Nobody ever took it out on the other person's graduate students. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Morton might be fighting with Groves or something, but he wouldn't ever invent it. So that they were very honorable about that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, as a graduate student in my first year, I didn't know much about any of it was going on.
Who were you working with?
Perlman.
Mm-hmm.
See, I came expecting to work with in the big course with as a teaching assistant to Mr. Kiekhofer in the big principal's class.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to the office, Miss Bridgman said, Mr. Perlman wants to see you. I said, what about? She said, well, go down and ask him. I said, well, do you have any idea? Well, he was up here looking through the folders of the new people and maybe he wants to talk to you about teaching or something. So I went to see him. He wanted me to be his teaching assistant. Well, that was a great honor for me, you see, because it was my own field, and he could have the pick of a lot of... I didn't know at the time when he asked me, and I agreed to it, that there was Bill Knowles was coming in, who had been his assistant before and expected to be, continue to be. So he hadn't told me or told Bill that.
Oh, I see. So,
and so I got a little... Bill didn't take kindly to that, but that was not my fault. And I had a wonderful relationship with Selig Perlman. Over many years, I had the most ideal situation as a graduate student. First place, he always treated me as a colleague.
Mm-hmm.
And worked that first year. I taught in four different courses, assisted him in four different courses, only one of which I'd ever had. So I attended all his lectures. And over there in the Historical Society are my notes in longhand, because we had a deaf mute in the class who couldn't read his lips with his Russian accent.
Yeah.
So then by the end of the year, I had several assistants. So I was sort of a foreman. But the department at that time, then Ed Witte became chairman somewhere in there in that period.
Somebody refers to him, Bronfenbrenner, as King Log.
Well, I suppose that's derogatory in a sense.
It seems so. I assumed that he was somebody who didn't really do anything about the problems the department was having.
He did a great deal. He was a very good man. Martin Bronfenbrenner was quite bright and sometimes almost, you know, he just didn't know what was going on. He didn't understand how things worked, really. And he was always looking for something. He was always moving. I remember when he left here, decided to leave here, he got an offer from Michigan State. I said, Martin, why are you going from here to Michigan State? He said, well, if you're at Wisconsin, you can't get an offer from a good place, but if you're at a poor place like Michigan State, you can. So he went there, and they gave him a leave so he could go to Japan, which was what he really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And but by the time he came back, he'd made an agreement to go to Minnesota. You know, he jumped around like that. Martin was, he used to come into my office and pound it. When are we going to raise the standards around here? And I'd say, well, go ahead. He said, what do you mean, go ahead? I said, well, you just teach a little better. He was one of the best teachers we had. That would infuriate him. But if we ever had an Oriental student who was in difficulties, Martin was always the one who wanted to pass him. He just, you know, he was enamored of Japan.
Mm.
He had a Japanese wife who didn't like to live in Japan. It was very difficult for her, her health. But he wanted to live there, you see, as much as possible. So part of his whole life was bent getting grants. But he was a very good teacher, and I used to kid him a lot. But he didn't, from my point of view, he didn't have a lot of common sense. Now, he wasn't the only one who criticized Mr. Witte. But Mr. Witte was a stabilizing force for a while in the department. Eventually, he couldn't take it anymore from Morton, who pounded him all the time. And it was support from these, with the Bronfenbrenner and people like that. Now, behind Bronfenbrenner's back, of course, Morton would run him down to beat hell and to criticize him. But to his face, he would... And he, see, all the, as the new people came in, Morton would cultivate them. It would take them 4 or 5 years, 3 or 4 years, to discover that he'd been feeding them things that were not either half-truths or untrue, or telling them that somebody was out to get them.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of, that's the way he operated.
Mm.
And so he worked with Bronfenbrenner at first, you see, and then behind Bronfenbrenner's back, he would denounce him as being foolish. I saw a lot of that.
When did Bronfenbrenner come?
I can't remember the year, but...
it must have been the late 40s.
Then. Yes, late 40s. No, probably early 50s.
Well, he
could have been 49 or 50, but you see, because Ellsworth and... I think Ellsworth came just before the war. He and Morton were close for a while, and Ellsworth discovered what a scoundrel he was in his dealings with...
But they seem to have voted together on a lot of things.
For a long time they did, you see. And then, but it was finally, was Ellsworth helped bring
That's
Morton
right.
down.
You said that in your interview,
mm-hmm.
that he said, we've got to be honest with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. I would guess that, and Morgan came in 48, and I think maybe Bronfenbrenner came 49, 50.
I don't know why I'm asking you.
You've got all the stuff.
He came in 50.
Yeah, and then
I'm trying to remember whether it was he or Groves who said that the decision about raises in the department were not being backed up by Dean Ingram. That the department, I think, didn't want to go on the merit system. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, I don't know the details of it, no. You see, one of the things they would do was sit around the table and discuss each other's salaries, and that, you know, left wounds that last the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
So the condition that I took the chairmanship on was that I would consult with everybody about every salary except their salary and mine.
Mm-hmm.
Mine I'd leave to the dean. And then I'd put something together as a package, and they'd take it up or down, the whole package, no changes.
I see.
And I carried it off. And that stopped a lot of the problems.
So that had been going on up to the time you became chairman.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Groves had said that he hadn't raised Morton's salary, and he thought because he thought Morton was such a troublemaker, and he thought Morton mm-hmm. was angry about him, and that was a reason for this attack mm-hmm. in 1945.
Yeah, well, whatever the reason was, I suspect it could well have been, I don't know.
Groves said he felt badly about that, and that he wished that he hadn't, that he felt it was he was ill-advised to have taken, done the work, which I gather was with businessmen,
yeah,
manufacturers.
Well, you know, it wasn't ill-advised to do that. In hindsight, it cost him a great deal. See, Groves' advice to me after that, when I became chairman, was don't fight Morton, you can't win. He didn't know what a devious Yankee I was. Or how stubborn I was.
Because you had a planned way of fighting. Is that right? Somebody
well,
said
I
thought you would have had a scheme for
well,
doing it.
I didn't have a scheme. I never had a scheme for anything.
I should tell you what you told me before,
what
by
did
the
I tell
way. We didn't talk about this much, but you did say that, I think it was Perlman came to you and said, I can't... You told me that. I think that's...
Yes. Perlman said he couldn't stand up to him, and he was always hammering him. And so I said to Perlman, well, in that case, I'll protect you. Just everybody will understand you have no influence over me whatsoever. I pay no attention to you on departmental matters, so that'll protect you from Morton. That hurt his feelings.
Yeah.
But Mr. Perlman, in some ways, was a personal coward, you see. A great man, you know. Mm-hmm. Because I say that about him, doesn't mean I don't have the greatest admiration for him, because there's greatness, but when it came, he couldn't take that kind of, he couldn't say, get the hell out of here and leave me alone. Just
well, a great many people couldn't. I mean, that's where things are very hard to take, actually.
Yeah.
Well, how do Perlman and Witte differ? You know, one hears about these great men from the past, and you put them all in the same little slot, and they must have been very different.
Very different, completely different. And I was close to both of them. They weren't terribly close to each other.
That's odd. I mean, one thinks of them as being like
yeah,
this.
I know, because they were in time at the same time. But Perlman was a Jewish intellectual who read and spoke many languages, was not and stuck most of the time, with exception when he was with the Industrial Commission. He had a job when he was very young, which took him to, which was an interesting story, to Lowell, Massachusetts. But for the rest of the time, he stuck to his last of teaching and writing. Witte started got his degree in history, started his career in the Legislative Reference Library, where he met legislators and drafted bills, and from ever afterwards he was involved in public policy and became a national figure, was the executive director of this group that wrote the Social Security Act, did tremendous things and wrote great quantities of stuff. Perlman didn't write very much, but what he wrote was very good and very solid, and I just, maybe I told you, I reviewed his book for some group recently, and it's just as fresh today as it was when it was written. His theory of the labor movement.
Is he the scholar you admire the more of the two, then?
For different reasons. See, the different kinds of scholarship. Perlman's was the insight and the intellectual, putting a theory together, taking the whole thing and putting it together so it had some meaningful, more meaningful. Mm. But Witte turned out great quantities of very useful materials, more current materials
applied
at the time,
applicable.
You see. Mm. Now, being the kind of person he was, Mr. Perlman didn't have as much respect for that, all that activity, you see, because that, you know, we always think what we're doing is more important than what the other fellow's doing. Witte grew up on a farm in Jefferson County, and when I wanted to tease him, we'd be riding back from Illinois or someplace, I'd say, don't you think we better stop and get a case of colored oleo? He just go right up. He was very proud that he drafted the bill, the color oleo purple. Well, they're just completely different
kinds
of people, you see.
So it's a Perlman that Nathan Feinsinger would have said he was a man who was only interested in theory and who didn't understand how things really worked. Is that, do you think that would...
Well, Nate could have said something like that, yes.
He was talking about a case up in Minnesota.
Yes, it, perhaps it was. Although people underestimated Perlman's understanding of things. He always poo-pooed, you know, he didn't understand theory, economics theory. His son Mark was a graduate student and worked his master's degree here. One time I came in the office and he was explaining Keynes to Mark, and he understood it very well. I understand. So, he could understand the concept of it, but he couldn't do it. He could describe very accurately the development of the steam engine, how it worked, what was behind it, and its importance in the Industrial Revolution. But Bob Fleming lived across the street from him.
Yeah.
One day, one of the girls came dashing across. Have I told you the story?
No.
Come quick, our house is flooding. Mr. Perlman had softened the water, but he hadn't got the cap back on when he opened it up, and he didn't know what he'd done. He could hardly change it. Change the fuse, I mean, you know, a light bulb or something. But he would understand the theory of it. So it's different. When he was at some stage in his life, somebody told him you had to slam the door of a Model T.
Uh-huh.
So forever after, he slammed people's car doors when he got out. And he didn't have a car, and would ask for a ride, and like Mrs. Perlman didn't mind calling up any of their friends and asking them if they're going somewhere to take them and so on, when the taxis were cheap. But I was, all, whenever he got out of the car, I'd always lean over and hold my door, catch the door before he broke the window. Well, it was marvelous. Mr. Whitty, I remember once we were going to a economics meeting in Des Moines, and he and I were sitting in the back seat. He was explaining the history of the area we're traveling through, which he knew because he was a very good American historian in the Middle West. He had a PhD, and he'd worked in all this stuff. At the same time, he was writing a speech. When he was very ill, must have been 55, 56, Kohler was governor. They were trying to put through merger.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Whitty was bleeding internally, I know that. And we had just a few hours to put in a substitute bill, which got the University of Milwaukee. He sat down at his desk, wrote out in longhand that draft of that bill, cited all the passages, didn't even look at the appropriate passed legislation, and it just like that. So he had a marvelous memory. We'd go to Economics Association meetings, we'd have a Wisconsin breakfast. And he'd get up, he took great pride in getting up and introducing everybody by name. But it would always be one or two he would forget, and those people would be so embarrassed that Mr. Williams should ever forget. But once he got something in his head that was wrong, there was no way in hell of getting it out. He used to go around saying two or three things I've forgotten them at the moment. They'd come back to me sometime. He would say as being true. They were absolutely untrue, but you couldn't. Yeah, he was. Oh, they were. Well, I was too long an answer to your short question, but these were marvelous, exciting people. And the other thing about Mr. Whitty, he had great many friends, and he worked very hard at getting jobs for students. He wrote reference letters. He loved to dictate. Oh, he loved to dictate. And he'd write these three, four-page letters. Well, around the country, his letters were very famous, but nobody took them too seriously because he found good things to say about anybody and everybody.
Well, Kearney has that reputation,
yes,
too.
Well, it isn't a bad reputation, you know.
No, of course not.
No.
Well, that's a question I was going to. You mentioned Keynesian economics, and I wondered how, whether the department was excited when this came out in 1936, is that right?
The book was, I think it was published,
but
it was 36 years, came around.
It was sort of percolating through,
yes,
is that right?
Yes.
So that it wouldn't really have hit the United States for a while.
Until 37, 38. Of course, In economics, like any professional, the profession gets these things very fast.
Uh-huh.
You see, the general theory. I guess do I have it here?
I have a copy here. I suspect my copy is at home. I will look at the date, but that's near enough for purposes. From the publication, a general theory. I guess it's at home.
His first explication of it.
I suppose maybe some of the ideas had been talked about, but it was put together.
Yeah.
In that monumental work.
But wasn't it all in the mid-40s? I mean, when you came here, was it still something that people were talking about and debating?
Oh, yes, yes. And, all the younger people, it was gospel. In fact, I was lecturing about this to my class the other day.
Oh, really?
In that time, we knew the answers to all these problems because we got them from Keynes.
So yeah. People really...
But by 47, Morton was calling this plumbing economics.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Although later, earlier on, he'd accept some of it.
See? That's what I read, that he had.
Yeah, sure. But, you see, he's very bright. Walter Morton's an extraordinarily bright person. And have you interviewed him yet?
Well, Donna interviewed him, and I... Insertion, the Morton interview is restricted.
But he can be, but he's very bright.
I mean,
but
he was just saying the stories about... In fact, I guess I'll ask you some of the...
Yeah, okay. Now, of course, you and I wouldn't have the same interpretation of things. He supported me for the chairmanship, voted for me. He assumed that I would take his advice, you see. I didn't have any... they needed me so desperately that I didn't have to sign any contracts in advance for whose advice I'd take. So it came to a shock to him when I didn't. And then he turned against me very heavily. But, he's...
This is 54, isn't it? So there is already 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Well, how many people in the department? About 14?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, but you've got more information right there than I can remember.
But it's just lines.
Yes, no, but I can remember some of the things in between those lines.
Yes.
But Morton was a very good critic. He gave a seminar that you had... every graduate student felt he had to take, because Morton was chairman of the theory committee for years.
Yes, what do you mean by that?
Well, everybody had to take an exam in theory.
In economic theory?
Yes, that was fundamental.
Would that be Keynesian economics?
Well, Keynesian economics, all kinds of economics.
Both kinds, yes.
And there was a committee, but he chaired it, you see. Now, later on, as I discovered, he would sound gruff and people were scared of him, but I never knew him to really use his... I've seen him ridicule students in class terribly, but I never knew when the final got down to it whether anybody got a grade or flunked because of Morton. Mm. But they felt they had to take his course. Well, the first 7 or 8 weeks was kind of refreshing because he was a great critic. But then after that was just repetition. And he never had any constructive contributions. I don't think if you went back over the literature, you'd find very much that Walter Morton did, except criticize.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I saw the editorial he wrote in the Cap Times on Groves, and it was very well written. I could see that he lost his capacity to write.
You see, and for Evu to fall in, but see, Evu was not a greatest man that ever lived. A lot of people in this town talk about.
I suppose why not to get sidelights on him? He won't appear unless somebody went down there, but from the university, he must have had a big influence in causes that he espoused.
And you see, it was a liberal paper. People regularly came to Madison, joined the faculty, saw this liberal paper, refreshing, and for 2 or 3 years they went with it, and then they discovered it wasn't so, and it was petty. And this is why the subscription keeps going down is we're not getting a lot of new people. Everybody here knows him, knows the paper. Although I think the paper's getting better. They were in real trouble 2 or 3 years ago, and Maury Rubin did a I don't know if you knew about it.
No.
He interviewed 100 people on why, what's wrong with the cat. So what I was telling what I thought. I said, maybe nobody else like. He says, yes, everybody's like, has the same ideas about it. And then they've changed it some. They made no announcement they were changing. Mm-hmm. But Evie was the kind of person who would hook up with a guy like Morton, you see.
One of the things Morton said was that the place was run by a matriarch. He was very, Elizabeth Brandeis was somebody he apparently disliked intensely.
He kept her from getting tenure until I became chairman, then I gave her tenure. I put it through.
Oh, I thought, I didn't realize that she could have gotten it. I thought that as a part-time instructor, she couldn't. You mean they would have done it sooner?
They hadn't been afraid he'd cause such a fight.
Was it because of her, or just because she was a woman, or because she was...
She didn't agree with him. She was a friend of Groves, Elizabeth didn't put up with that nonsense, you know. And of course, he also was denounced her husband some, who was Paul Rauschenbusch. Paul was more vulnerable in some ways than Elizabeth.
Mm. Well, what about, let's see, he mentioned... Mrs. Otto, Mrs. Goss. This interests me just because I'm interested in the influence that faculty wives may have had on things. And did a group of women have any kind of influence on the campus? Mrs. Dykstra, too, is a little...
Well, see, I didn't know Mrs. Dykstra.
Yeah.
I knew Mrs. Goss, and I knew Mrs. Otto slightly. Well, they had influence the way women do now, to some extent. It's more diverse. There are more people now. But Mrs. Goss, we used to go. He was my minor professor, so we used to go to their house quite a bit. Mm. She was a very nice lady. I never thought of her as having tremendous influence. In some small circle, they may have expressed their opinions, but they didn't make the decisions. They influenced them. Every wife influenced, you know, women always, the women's lib is nothing new, really. I mean, you make a lot of noise about it, but in our society, women have been a tremendous, it was their intellectual, if they were intellectually strong, they had a lot of influence. Some of them got it by status that they were very active. I suppose Mrs. Dykstra would be using the president's house as a social center.
Yes.
Mrs. Harrington didn't do much of that. She loved...
Well, this is just... Administrators' wives do. I think that's... Mm-hmm.
But you see, when I came and before I came, there were many more social affairs that involve students, and for instance, we went to the Gosses a good deal. We were at the Perlmans and the Witties and so on as graduate students.
Yes.
And now, probably I more than many, I've lived a charmed life around here. I've been treated so well. But others did too, and departments were smaller, so that the social life of a department was by the very nature of the size. I suspect if you took a very small, we'd find some small departments here now where almost everybody's involved in the social situation, know each other, you see, that's where the wives get their words in, and in those discussions, you see.
And this was true in the economics department, in spite of Morton. There was still social life.
Oh, a lot of social life, yes, You know, Morton wasn't ostracized. He hasn't been since, really, unsocially.
Huh.
People liked his wife.
You said he was a charming person.
Could be very charming.
Could be, yeah.
And his wife is a very fine person.
Huh.
She put up with a hell of a...
That's interesting.
Yes, indeed. And if she would talk, and I'm sure she won't.
She won't.
No, I don't think she will. But... do you know Mrs. Her name is Rice now.
Oh, yes. Briggs.
Briggs.
Hazel Briggs. Several people have mentioned her as somebody.
Isn't she Mrs. Morton's sister?
Oh. Yeah, I think that may be.
I think so. Anyway, there's a Anyway, she was close to them. They're close to her, I think. So, she's close to Elizabeth Brandeis. And she's old enough. She knew those people, you and Clegg and all those people. Mm. She could tell you a lot of things that you might not learn on the campus.
Yeah.
If Hazel wanted to talk. She's a very alert person.
Well, we better...
Get on with your questions.
Yes. I'm interested in the School for Work, because you talked some about that. Mm-hmm. And as I pictured the campus, there were these labor economists, and the School for Work was founded in the 20s when there was a liberal government. And then in the in the 40s, when there was a very conservative governor, and perhaps Elwell was very influential here, one suddenly sees this big push against or for more help to business and to management, and gets the Industrial Relations Committee, mm-hmm. and the Industrial Management Institutes. I'd like some perspective on them, how important they were on the campus, say, as compared to things that were going on in the Ag School and Extension. And
I think the Industrial Management Institute came out of some wartime act, but there was a chap here working, some musician, whom I still get Christmas cards from, and is retired, and I can't think of his name at the moment. He's left the campus years ago.
It's not Moberly.
Moberly, yes.
Ah.
Moberly. Here's a charmer.
Huh.
He became very close to Elwell. And so Elwell set up this management institute, and with Moberly as director of it.
But was that thought of as a reasonable thing to do? I mean, do you think it was?
An unreasonable thing to do, to work with management.
Mm-hmm.
Most schools have management institutes.
Mm, right.
The thing that was wrong with this one was that they had a musician in charge. and there was apparently a little bit of a scoundrel, because it eventually double-crossed Elwell in some fashion and got fired. That's what happened to him. I've forgotten the details of it, but Russ Moberly was really a good... He would have been a good man in the music man. He would... He's still very friendly to me, and you know, but what I think there was a push for the management to take over the School for Workers, you see, and run it as a sub-branch. And this is why Witte and Feinsing and the others wanted the Industrial Relations Center, which would come as a kind of in-between.
Huh.
See, the management people thought the university should teach the workers to be good and behave.
Yes, one gets that very strongly.
Yes,
some of the
and
the
through this thing. And of course, Elwell was feeding all kinds of stuff about how radical the department was and a bunch of communists and so on. That's where I had my showdown with him on that one. And the School for Workers was not completely clean-handed.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I meant that they felt that they weren't beyond being a university representatives. They felt themselves, some of the staff, they were organizers of the workers.
I see.
And it was mostly socialists, young socialists.
Mm-hmm.
This is how I got into the act. Schwarzstrauber was an old-time socialist, very fine person. And but when he hired people, they hired socialists and on the staff. And some of these young fellows were quite, militant, maybe is a little strong. But they knew that some people in their classes were going back and telling management was said. So they would say things about the management just because it just annoyed them, you see.
Yeah.
And so it was things like that. And the other thing is that the School for Workers, technically a part of Extension, tried to keep as far from the university as it could. And so you had that kind of thing.
And eventually the university took it over, didn't it?
So that was my job, really.
I see. That happened after you became director.
Well, technically it was before. See, it was always part of the university.
Well, I mean, but
to really getting it into the university. That's what I did.
But the Fred's files begin to have a folder, committee yeah. for school yeah. for school for workers.
Yes.
So the
mm-hmm. yes.
he was keeping an eye on it.
Well, that's why I got in there, because you see, when the conservative business people would call the conservative regents, they'd call Fred.
Yeah, Sensenbrenner especially.
Yes, he was chairman of the board.
Oh, he kept a his file is this thick, and every single thing that happens, he writes a letter about.
Yes. Oh, E.B. Fred was one of the great presidents, but people didn't understand how he handled all.
Do you really mean that?
Yes, in this respect. He kept those reactionary regents from laying a hand on the university. During the McCarthy period, we were scot-free.
That was purely because of Fred's efforts?
More than anybody else. And I used to think when I was young that he was just didn't know much what he was doing up there. But he really did know he was very sharp. And when he was talking about Virginia and cows and things, that was part of the act. I'm convinced. Now he wasn't terribly interested in the things I was interested in.
No,
he was there to guard the egg school. I thought mostly, but he really guarded the university. We defended. We're the only public university in the country that kept the young communists on the campus in that period.
This University of Michigan history contains what they went through, and you can see that it's very different. They had to get rid of...
Yeah, and E.B. Fred is responsible for that more than anybody else. That's what he did. He was on the phone with those people. Look what he put up with.
Was it because of... he himself was a little bit afraid of communists, and
I am too. I don't trust him ever.
Oh, I see. All right, that's fair enough. And you know the post, this business about the journals from East European countries, whether they should be...
Part I didn't know about, but I do know about that E.B. Fred, he called Ulrichsen in to get the ammunition to defend the school for workers, and Ulrichsen misunderstood and attacked Fred for assuming that he was being criticized in the school for workers, you see.
Well, this has been about 1948, so there's no record of this.
Late 49, early 50.
Oh. I guess it just didn't get into the files.
No, because it was an oral matter,
yeah.
You see. Now, Ulrichsen would have been the ideal director for the School for Workers. He was not a socialist. He was a dyed-in-the-wool trade unionist, but he was a man of integrity, but he was an older man. He was probably 10, 15 years older than me, maybe, you know, something like that. He was widowed and came here to do graduate work, and he came down, he thought he should be Perlman's. Another one of the people thought he should be Perlman's assistant, you see.
Oh, so he was here as a student?
Yes,
to begin with.
Graduate student.
Oh, that's right, you did, okay.
Yeah. And so it was in an attempt to defend him that the thing blew up, because once he started denouncing E.B. Fred, you know, that finished him. It came about because E.B. Fred was trying to defend him. But Mr. Fred, look, Mr. Fred defended people that he didn't agree with at all.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't defending his friends. He was defending academic freedom. And he did it in a very rough time. And but he was on the phone all the time with those characters. And the other thing he did endlessly was stack the committees. I mean, not well, in a way, he was very, very careful who was on committees. And he used to worry about salaries. He didn't understand the budget, but he would worry about who got raises. But, you know, but it was a time when you needed somebody who could stand up. See, the Dykstras couldn't live with those people. Fred Harrington wouldn't have lasted.
Do you think Dykstra really did resign because of the School of Commerce? I've heard this.
I don't know a thing about
because
it.
Because he was defeated on that.
Don't know. Or was he asked not to come back? I don't know. See, I don't really know.
Yeah, it's not in the files. It's great until you get his letter of resignation.
Yes.
And, you know, I've been offered a nice job.
Yes.
But
the person who does what you're doing 20 years from now will have nothing in the files.
That's right. Because nobody's writing these things.
We can't write anything.
Yeah.
Somebody will sue you. Every time there's a charge of discrimination or somebody doesn't get promoted, a minority or woman, we get all this, the lawsuits.
Yeah, yeah.
So, on, you know, nobody's going to put anything down. And I don't pay, I would no more paying attention to a reference letter.
Yeah.
And I, of course, from an historian, I'm impossible. I've never kept a log of telephone calls. I never write memos. I've lived all right. I got along all right.
Yes, it is. It is fun to go through the files when people were writing little notes on the edges of memos.
Yes,
very explicit
yes.
About it.
You haven't found much of mine, have you?
No.
No.
I haven't.
Well,
you're right. It
wasn't a deliberate plan. It was part of laziness.
I can see that.
But
also, I can see the need, because you were in, after all, the late 60s. I mean, there's quite a difference.
Well, my office was broken into. My files ransacked.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I didn't wholly trust everybody down in the archives either. I had some reason to, because I had some evidence that some of the things that were supposed to be confidential got leaked years ago.
Hmm.
Now, not the guy who was running it,
but
had some people working for him who were, you know, once you have the answer, the true religion, whatever it is, the end justifies the means.
Yeah.
And whether some, whatever it is, whether right or left, those people, I would never trust them.
Yes, that was certainly a time when everybody thought that. Elwell was not put on the committee to set up this industrial relations, which was very interesting.
Center,
yes.
Yeah.
And I imagine that was
that
would have been Fred's doing that, because
with advice from Whitty,
Gomnitz. What was Gomnitz?
Gomnitz was. Was sort of center of the road. How he lived with and stood with Elwell all those years, I don't know, but he managed. He was kind of a buffer between.
I
knew
him.
What?
Was he a man you could trust?
Oh, sure. I'm very fond of Irv. He wasn't a dynamic guy, and but he was not. He was respect. He wanted to be a respectable professor. He was a good teacher, by all reports. He would talk endlessly. So I never let him in my office when I was dean or chairman or chancellor. I would always go to his office so I could leave. But we worked together on projects. We used to go down. Jointly went to Racine night week after week to talk to help some business group.
When was that?
When I've forgotten. One year he and I taught a course. I was offered a chance to teach economics for school teachers, and I said, mm-hmm. I won't, you know, I'll take half pay and use the other half and hire Gomnitz. They ought to hear both sides, because he was a little more conservative than
mm-hmm.
I. But when we got in there, it wasn't really that much different. We're both economists, you
mm-hmm.
see. He was basically
mm-hmm. Oh, I see. An economist.
Economist, yes.
Even though he was in the business school.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Most people in business schools, see, were trained in mm-hmm. economics. Elwell was an exception. He was an accountant.
Yeah.
But, again, one of the tragedies, has anybody ever told you about why Elwell never got a degree?
Yes.
Yeah, you see? He couldn't. And so it was always a problem with him. But it was no reason. He did it. The university persuaded him to teach instead of getting a degree. I kind of liked the old boy. He had to kick him in the teeth once in a while, verbally, but that's what he understood. He was a bully.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very clear.
Yeah, that's why I got along with him. He thought I was a radical. but
so you became I missed anything here. Fleming came to head this up, and Feinsinger brought him here.
Mm-hmm. He'd known him at the Wall Labor Board. Well, the other thing is, Fleming had been a
law student.
Law student.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The economics department wasn't wholly in sympathy with his industrial relations. Research Institute.
Outside of the labor people. No. I don't know. They didn't have much to do with it. It was set up sort of outside, and so they might have in some passing way, but most of the things that did, it didn't have any courses, so there was no conflict in teaching, and it was really supposed to, was a device to head off the school for workers being taken over by Elwell. That's why the Institute set up.
Just, in other words, that Witte and
Feinsinger.
And Feinsinger worked at, invented.
Yeah. Well, they were being set up around the country, too. It was quite fashionable to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some business people wanted it set up, too, because there were some who thought this was the way to teach labor to behave.
Yeah. Yes. It's lovely to see that. It should. What's in the public interest? I see.
Yes,
that's
yes.
What labor and management have
yep.
to do.
Well, maybe they were right. Mm. The record isn't all in yet.
And you became head of both of these for a while.
Yeah, let's see. How does it go? 1950, I became director of the School for Workers on a half-time basis, because everybody said, look, if you take that thing, you're finished. And nobody can ever survive being mixed up with that crowd. As academically, career-wise.
Uh-huh.
But
why did you take it then?
Because Witte and Perlman told me, asked me to do it, said it was necessary, it would go down the drain. See, they had it rigged so it would go down the drain if I didn't. I mean, I did. Elrickson went around the state and got a pledge from every union that if they didn't make him director and went outside and brought in a director, that they would boycott it.
I see.
And Witte and Feinsinger and Perlman thought this was too valuable to have it destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And it never occurred to Elrickson that there was anybody in the state that could do it. Well, I had no interest in it, no knowledge about it. I was drafted. Mm-hmm. And I said,
well, why you? You were very young.
Yeah, why me?
Hmm.
I was the only one to kick around, I guess.
Well, that's
the only one that there weren't many people available, you know, that they had confidence in, could trust.
Was this your first administrative
yes.
job?
I didn't want it. I wanted to be a professor. But that's where I got off the track, right there. Then 2 years later, I got out of that one because got this guy in working for me, Ozan.
Yes, well, you said that, but you didn't explain why. And you said somebody joked and said if you let him in, he'll
yeah. Well,
he'll
why got him? Well, he came and we needed some help. And I think it was Ulrichsen who'd hired him originally. But see, Bob had been an organizer for the retail clerks out in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And he was natural to work in school for workers.
Was he an academic?
Well, he came here to do graduate work. He decided he wanted to be an academic,
mm-hmm.
and so he was working for the School for Workers as a, you know, he was a person who was a little older, and he had this background, an ideal background for the job. And so when he came over there, and I recognized that he didn't have much ideology, but he was, you know, knowledgeable.
Not much ideology.
I mean, he wasn't a socialist by, you know, conviction. You had to be this way, this was the only right way to uh-huh. go, or something like that. I'm not, you know, I'm... Because people were socialists, I would no reason for not hiring them. But it's more comfortable if they've got to survive in a situation where their socialism demands that they have confrontation with some very reactionary employers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he was smart, and we didn't have a lot of room, so I brought him right into my office, and we shared an office.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew everything went on, and then people were warning me that he would take my job, and it was exactly what I wanted. So, I got...
But you put together the statement warning you, and you wanted that, so that doesn't sound... Those things don't go together.
Well, I thought
they're saying,
don't worry,
and he'll take your job, you don't have to keep it anymore.
Well, see, I thought it was very amusing when they warned me, because he... See, they warned me against what I wanted to happen. See, these people were trying to be helpful to me, you see.
Mm.
No, I thought it was great fun. Because it's exactly what I had in mind. He was going to take my job. And at the end of 2 years, I got out. But that was the time when Fleming left. And there was the Industrial Relations Center. See, so I had to pick that up.
Tell me about why Fleming left, because Nathan Feinsinger said that, Elwell got rid of Fleming.
Well,
but it doesn't look that way in the files, naturally.
No, it never looks that way in the files. Two things. One, why would he leave? Well, first, they offered him a very attractive position.
That's
money and an important budget and shop, which was very good, you see. And so anyone might have left under any circumstance for that. But there was some push from this side in that everything he tried to do in bringing labor and management together, Elwell frustrated, because Elwell had a close friend who was running the Manufacturers Association, Evans. Uh-huh. And Evans worked at getting them to boycott everything that Fleming tried to do. See, Fleming was the middle of the rover. He was neither labor nor management.
Yeah, yeah.
He just absolute straight guy. He only ever double-crossed me once.
When?
Oh, this is... Now, can you shut the thing off?
Yes.
Fleming, and so that this constant frustration, trying to set up a conference and then having it boycotted by some people, having the you're trying to work with industry and labor, mm-hmm. and you've got the industry people boycotting you. Well, they're organized in an organized fashion. Now, everybody did this. Bob had many friends among us, because personally, you know, everybody trusts Bob Fleming. Mm-hmm. He's just absolutely tops. And as I say, with this one episode, outside of that, that's a pretty good record over 40 years. Anyway, he went down there and he did very well. And then got a chair.
Well, wait a minute. Don't leave that story. I just wonder, here was the Industrial Management Institute going on mm-hmm. at the same time.
Yes.
And presumably these industrialists thought, I mean, they may have seen them as two things, one for labor and one for them, instead of realizing that the one was supposed to be for both.
Oh.
Was that?
No, they understood the game. But these people were so anti-labor, they didn't want to be on the same platform with labor people.
Like the Israeli and the Syrian last night.
Yes. About, you know, that kind of thing. It was very, very bitter. And so, but we had some other programs going, you know. We had the German students here, which is a whole other thing.
Oh, yes, I saw it.
Some things like that. Yeah. So I had, and they didn't want it to die, so I picked it up. We reorganized it more, and we stuck the word research in, I believe, at that stage.
Yes.
And then out of it has grown the present program, which is a pretty good one. But I kept it alive. I wasn't very dynamic about it. I wasn't interested. The other thing is, I didn't want it to be a degree program.
In fact, why not?
I think that, I'm conservative, I thought this would pull the labor people and their interests out of the department, out of weight, you see,
mm-hmm.
and the students. And my own view is, if you're going to be dealing in labor matters, you ought to know economics much more than psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Now that may not be good, but you know what, it's my narrow view.
Yeah.
Sociologists and psychologists haven't been tremendously successful in these things. They weren't. And anyway, we had a long tradition in the department. I wanted to maintain the department's tradition, you see, of the past, and that was part of it. Also, I guess I really believe that a degree needs a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And industrial relations really, at that time, wasn't a discipline, and it may be getting to be one, but it's a little confused still. Though we turn out some very good people, and they get very good jobs, and you know, so on. But anyway, I probably was wrong, but that was my position. And then, when I went to Europe in 1955, I took a year off. And Reed Tripp became the director.
Was he brought in for that?
No, Reed was brought in we needed another person in the department to teach labor. There was a lot of course, a lot of work to be done. Reed was a fine, splendid person. He wasn't a very good teacher. He could, on a one-to-one basis, he could teach a great deal. He had lots of insights. He was never terribly popular with some of his. I'm no great scholar. Never was, never will be, because I intended to do it, but they never gave me time, and I don't feel that I that I had any great thing to offer, so I have no regrets about it. But Reed worked at things, but didn't get the respect of his colleagues in the department. I was on good terms with everybody except Walter, and even with him, we're still cordial. He's forgiven me everything he ever said about me, most of the time.
At least to your face.
Probably. To my face, yes, and that's good enough, you see. So, but Reed, I think probably Mr. Whitty brought Reed in.
Well, I know, but people thought Feinsinger should have been there. I guess that was, when was that? Was that at that point that thought Feinsinger should have been head of IRRI?
I don't know, but I can't believe. Probably he would have been great if he would have done it, but he was too busy. He was making three times his university salary as outside the university at that time. Well, he had a very complicated family situation.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, I'll tell you too much. Well, again, some of this is gossip. I suppose most of the interesting things are. Gunnar Johansson was brought here, to be as a Brittingham artist in residence at piano. Nate was a very attractive bachelor.
I can imagine.
And he persuaded Mrs. Johansson to leave him, and she married Nate.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's...
And, of course, the man who lucked out on that was Johansson, because he's got a wonderful wife
yes,
now.
I've talked to him, and I know he has.
Maybe I wouldn't put it past Johansson to have rigged the whole thing.
Well, did Mrs. Feinsinger, when did she die?
She's still alive.
She is? Oh, they got divorced, did they? I often wondered about that.
Well, what happened, you see... I said he lived a complicated family life. After she married Nate, she refused to live in Madison. Oh. So she moved to Aspen, where Nate had some property that he got some. And so he spent his life teaching here, arbitrating around the country, and flying out to Aspen in all kinds of weather. Oh, my God, that man just did a letter. Because she would refuse to come to Madison after that divorce.
And are they still married?
No, they were divorced some years ago. The person who's kept Nate alive, really, was a woman named Roe.
Yeah.
One marvelous woman.
Was she?
Just marvelous.
I suddenly realized I should have interviewed her.
Yes.
She died.
She probably wouldn't have told you very much, but... they used to travel together, and I won't remember what I'm saying. Taking positions just like that, and I'd say, "Oh hell, let's go home and forget it." And he'd say, "Oh no, let's keep on talking." And he'd find some crack somewhere. He settled more disputes. I've never seen anybody like him. And the other thing is, he had tremendous stamina. Huh. I've been with him on where we didn't go to bed for two nights in a row, and I would be absolutely out. But he was, his national swimming champion when he was a student at Michigan. Where were we?
This is humor, I suppose. I suppose it was his humor in these situations that must have charmed everybody.
It was his humor and his imagination. Mm. He could think up things that they hadn't said no to yet.
I see.
It was great. I used to play straight man. I'd say, whichever side we were talking, I'd say, the public isn't going to stand for this damn foolishness. You guys are just absolutely out of your minds, you see. And I'd give him a lecture like that. Then Nate would come in and say, well, now I had to. It's not that bad. You guys aren't that bad. You could. I was just. Then we go and work the other side over. Oh, it was fun. I learned a lot from him. Every one of these people, I learned a great deal from. I liked very much. Coming back to the, and so the we carried the Institute along, cut back down on the attempt to bring things together, moved it in a kind of a holding pattern until we could get things cleared away to do something about it. One of the byproducts of all this, to my opinion, is that the Management Institute here has never risen to a very high status.
Is it still going on?
Oh, yes. It's a big operation, an extension. As I say, Mobley got fired because I've forgotten the details of how he double-crossed Mr. Elwell. He would double-cross anybody. Then the next fellow, Dick Sullivan, I think his name was, marvelous guy, just splendid person, and would have made something of that, and he had a brain hemorrhage and died very quickly. He was one of the most promising people on the management side this school had and could have done, was on the way to do it. And his successor was just somebody who's up there now and just very ordinary.
And so this is an extension appointment?
Yes, now. Yes, it's an extension. And the business school doesn't have much to say about it anymore. Elwell did when he was there. It's now, it does a lot for the, the supervisors and sales managers and so on, but this isn't the place where the top executives come to look. They go to the Graduate School of Business at Northwestern or something. So we've never gotten, it's never achieved the status in the business world that the School for Workers has in the labor world.
Mm-hmm. That's another example. It always seems to boil down to who's there.
Yes, it does. Makes a real difference at critical times.
Well, I'm trying to think of there any other things to ask you about the department in this period before the whole social studies, social sciences and international studies push got going. Because that was beginning in the 50s, wasn't it? The international.
There was a beginning of that. There wasn't a great deal of it in the 50s. I had my first international experience in the 50s.
Well, I think I would rather pursue to be sure that we get to it. Mm. The hiring of Orkin, and well, you brought Pete Steiner and Jerry Summers here before.
Mm-hmm.
They were econometricians.
No. Pete was not an econometrician. He understood the stuff. Mm. He was a general theorist. A very good one, and a very good statistician, but he was not an econometrics man. Jim Early, I think it was, who identified, you see, by any sensible thing, Jim should have been chairman instead of me. He was at a seniority, he was a full professor, but the fight with him, that time he'd been very close to Morton earlier on.
Uh-huh.
He'd been Morton's student, and then they'd broken, and so I was the youngest person with tenure in the department, and I didn't have any enemies.
At that time, were they voting for chairman? Was the whole department members
were voting? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They nominate by voting. And the dean had to accept it, but most of the time when I was dean, I accepted almost always, not always.
They hadn't yet started the three-year cycle, which seems to be standard now. I mean, you were chairman from 54 to 61.
Yeah, but was a year
with
of time.
A year out.
A year of time.
Yes, but I mean, you stayed in that
long. Yes, I didn't intend to, but it just seemed to be, things were moving and there were a lot of things going. You see, that was the period when we did tremendous changes in personnel.
In the department?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-mm. And
was Ingram, I just want to ask you, I don't, this isn't as disorganized as it sounds, but I have seen the statement that there was an anti-Ingram group on campus and that he wasn't pushing on fronts that some people thought he should, perhaps in the social sciences. Did he accept your appointments, and did you have any feelings about
him? I had great help from him. I found him very helpful. I was a little in awe of him. He seemed much older because he didn't have any hair, and he took me a while to learn what a sense of humor he had. Marvelous sense of humor. This is one of the wittiest people, you know. You read the stuff he writes, it's marvelous. But he kept that deadpan, but I went up there, and I had the utmost support from him.
Who would have been an anti-Ingram
group on campus? A man like Gillen was one of them. French Gillen. He was a wild man in French who... See, Mr. Ingram was very tough on giving raises to people who were no damn good.
No damn good. You're saying, I guess what Bronfenbrenner is saying, you said not to pay too much attention to him, but his objection was that anybody who was sort of odd and oddball and wild man didn't get raises and didn't get promotions.
Well, not if they were, if they just weren't very good academically, weren't doing things, either teaching well or researching well. Mr. Ingram would have a great deal of respect for genius. Uh-huh. You wouldn't expect him. Now, of course, Mr. Ingram had some pretty strict, I think he had more, was more concerned about people's behavior, too. He wanted them to be conventional. He wouldn't have put up with some things that I did as dean. I mean, in people's personal lives and idiosyncrasies. Hmm. He put up with a lot, but
I mean, that would have been a factor in his saying.
If he thought it affected the department. Uh-huh.
He couldn't do anything about Morton.
Morton was his mortal enemy. Morton hated him, and he hated Morton. But he couldn't. You see, alone he couldn't do. As a dean, you can't reach down and. Mm. And change the department, pick somebody up, you see.
Harrington wrote a long memo to Fred with suggestions as what to do about Morton. Did you know that?
I don't remember.
I have a copy of it here. There were several copies in the file, so I took one.
Well, I'd like to see that sometime. I wonder if it fell into place. I may even have seen it at the time.
Maybe you did.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, let's see. I can't remember the date of the showdown. Was this about the time when we were having that big row? I can't remember what date that was. Yes, this was the kind of thing they were talking about. Mm-hmm. But that was considered. I knew about that now that you showed to me. You want to talk about bringing stuff?
Yes.
Well, let me say that Jim Early was should have been the chairman, and Ellsworth were, once this decision made, I became chairman. Whatever we agreed to do, and whatever they backed me to the hilt, we settled our disagreements by consensus and discussion, and then we went ahead. Mm-hmm. And we always had enough votes to outvote Morton, Glazier, and whoever else they could bring around. And of course we had the Wilmot problem, which was a very serious problem.
Wilmot?
Yes.
What was that?
He was a person who was Mr. Kiekhofer's assistant and then taught the big course and didn't finish his degree, and they wanted Morton. He was very close to Morton and Glazier, and they wanted to get him promoted and kept. Uh-huh. You see, and he was not kept. That was a big row, and they got. It was a very serious matter. The name doesn't. he never got to be he got to be an assistant professor, I think.
That's what I didn't write
but
it down.
Beyond that, I were maybe only instructor. And there was very great bitterness. He was a good teacher. He rallied a lot of students, you know, for his support, but he either didn't finish his degree or didn't get anything else done. And he went to off to teach somewhere in Florida. Nice person, hard working, spent a lot of time with students, you know, but he fell in, he thought, Martin persuaded him he was his only protector. It's the worst thing he could do, is to join with Martin against the department.
Yes.
And Glazier, well, never, Glazier was always, and Martin were always close. Glazier again felt that it was, Martin could persuade people that everybody else was against him.
Yeah.
He had, and so Glazier, Wilmot. So there was that one problem. Well, anyway.
What about Lesko here? Well, just while we're still.
Yeah, Lesko here wasn't terribly important. You never knew just where. I think he generally decided would be. He might vote with Martin. He was a little bit out of the department. They didn't have a great deal of respect for him. Mm-hmm. He wasn't doing anything much, mm-hmm. and there wasn't. But he'd done some things earlier, and they let him work out his time. He had some personal problems, you know. His wife, I think, was I think she'd lost her mind or something, and he was living with Mary Amond or something like that. There was something going on, and then some. But he was sort of, he wasn't terribly important. He was a pleasant person to talk to. Again, I suspect he didn't get very much raises in those years, mm-hmm. because.
Well, go on then.
And let's see. So somewhere, I think it was Jim Early, but I'm not sure, who identified people retiring. We need some people. Pete Steiner, somewhere. And we persuaded Pete to come here. He was at Berkeley, I think, or before it came to us.
Mm-hmm. He eventually went to Michigan, is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Great person, one of the best teachers we ever had, one of the clearest minds and the best poker player I've ever known. When he came, he then brought Roger Miller from Berkeley. And later, Peter divorced his wife and married Roger's wife. And that's why they left, primarily, to go to Michigan.
Oh, I see. That's interesting, because one looks at it, one says, oh, well, he must have left because... when did he leave?
If he'd stayed here, he would have been one of the... He would have been
68.
He was one of the strongest people and
yes,
best people.
Yes, he apparently was very, well, highly thought of it in Michigan.
Yeah, oh, he is. He's fine. He got to be... He's a dean, isn't he, or something? Now? Or
maybe
chairman of the department at some stage, but he got to be president of the AAUP nationally, you know, after he left here. I used to kid him a bit because he didn't believe much in collective bargaining. Here he was head of an organization trying to promote it, and he'd say, well, no, we're not really, and so on. But that was one of the big losses
yes.
that we've ever had. Jerry Summers was quite a different situation. The labor field was expanding. We're looking forward to some retirements, you see, with Whitty and Perlman going and Miss Brandeis going. And we were looking around, and Elizabeth Brandeis had been at some meeting in... somewhere she ran into... that's not right. Well, somebody... some meetings, we ran into Jerry Summers. He was... And we were quite taken with him. And so we invited the people out and we viewed him and then we brought him here. And he was a great catch.
He was.
Hmm. Oh, yes. Just very, very good. He was a very good, very steady teacher, good teacher, terribly hard worker, and is a very steady scholar, of high quality. And one of the best people in the country, and then of course he died suddenly at a meeting. Do you know Rita? his wife?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah. I was very fond of him both. During the period of the Black Strike, Rita, for some reason, which I don't know, identified very closely with blacks, with the black cause. She came from Toronto, where the, you know, I don't think she had much to do with blacks ever, but she was way out. And she one time called me racist or something like that. Well, we're still good friends, by the way. But she just so... Yeah. And Jerry was the one who made the emotional speech that when we had 800 faculty members there that set up the Department of Black, of Afro-American Studies.
Oh, really?
He was the one that carried the swing vote because he was so respected.
Yeah.
And it was very unlike him. If he hadn't made that speech, we would have had a program, mm-hmm. you see, which was what we should have had.
Yes.
Because then you can evolve it. Instead of that, we got into all kinds of trouble. It's going to come along, and you know, some good people over there now, but anyway, that was one of those things. This is my opinion of what...
Yes, yes.
I think I'm fairly right about this. But outside of that one episode, that's one of the few times in my life I ever disagreed with Jerry, but he was such an absolute top drawer, scholar in person.
That's good to know.
Mm-hmm. Then... the future seemed to be going towards econometrics. And Pete Steiner and I would talk a lot, and Jim Early, and what we should do.
Now, this had already happened elsewhere in the country, hadn't it?
To some extent,
the
yes.
The departments had been...
Yes, it was moving along, yes, faster.
Wisconsin was quite a ways behind.
Yes, in this, yes. We wanted to do something big, and so... We talked about what we could do. Well, Pete said we should try to get Guy Orchard. Pete knew him from Harvard, where he was an associate professor. Well, it takes some money to get him, of course, because we wanted to bring anybody. We need money. So I went to Connie, Elvium, and Fred. Connie was graduate dean. Mm-hmm. And I asked for $100,000. Well, you know, I wasn't in agriculture. I wasn't in biology. And what the hell would anyone... But, you know, they were a little worried about the economics department in a bit, you know, and about me. I've done quite a lot of things around here at that time, and they wanted to appear to be helping. Now, this is what I heard later. I don't know if this is true, but I believe it to be true. They had a WARF board meeting in Milwaukee, and Connie and I was asking for WARF money, and Fred went over, and I'm told that they said to these guys, "Now look, Ed Young wants $100,000 to bring this guy Orchid. Now, he isn't going to get Orchid from Lee Harvard. So it's perfectly safe to promise them $100,000. That they did. Mm-hmm. Well, I went to Cambridge, and I went to see Sumner Slichter. You know, he was a Wisconsin man, mm-hmm. and a wonderful, wonderful man. And he was always willing to be helpful. But he said, "Ed, you know, you're not going to get any senior person from to leave Harvard and go to Wisconsin." And, I said, you're probably right. And he said, you know, I talked about Dorfman, and I talked about Orchid. I didn't want to show my hand too mm-hmm. fully, and I wasn't quite sure in my own mind, you see. I was...
As to whether you wanted Orchid.
Yeah, you know, or Dorfman, which one? See, mm-hmm. Either one would be a great catch, and... I wanted with somebody, and I thought I wanted these people, but if I told him which specifically,
yeah.
and that would have cut me off from the others, and I didn't know where I was going to get, so I was keeping my hands playing a little close to my chest too. Mm-hmm. Mr. Slick was just great, but he was so sure that I wasn't going to get anywhere. I was just wasting my time, so I visited with Dorfman, and I visited with Orchid.
Had you met either of them before?
No. Talked to them. And Orchid was quite interested. What had happened was that he was an associate professor. He was going to be promoted the next year, but he thought they were a year late promoting him. Mm-hmm. And Guy was a person who was restless in a way. He wanted to do some, he had this model in mind, he wanted to do this, but I want the money for it. And so I talked, and I liked him very much. He's just a very attractive person. And he said he would consider it. And so he'd have to bring certain people, and we're going to build this model of the American economy. And so we went through and brought him here and gave him some money, and one of the...
Now, wait, don't go so fast. Why had you decided on Guy?
Well, mostly Pete Steiner. You see, Pete Steiner told me that...
He'd already written.
Well, no, Pete knew them. You see, he was a student, a PhD from Harvard. And he knew these people, and he had some inkling from somebody that there was some restlessness there. But also, because Guy fitted what we needed. There weren't many people that really of a stature with this econometric model that we could... We had to make a quick catch up. And...
So when you went to Wharf, you said you still were not decided between Dorfman and Orchid.
Well, I mean, when I was talking to Mr. Slichter, because I hadn't met either of them,
and
I didn't know, Dorfman wasn't interested, so that crossed that off immediately, you see. I later got to know Bob Dorfman better in Pakistan, but he wasn't interested in leaving Harvard.
What interests me here is comments I've heard about Orchid. Not as a scholar, but as in the way that his failure to understand how departments work, which I guess was what got him in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if maybe that's why he was, if Harvard maybe didn't want him to stay.
I think one of the most interesting documents I've ever laid eyes on, I got to get a copy, but it's in the New York Times.
Is this 1971?
No, this was 19... Well, whatever year he came, what year did he come? You got your chart there?
58. Yeah.
Well, it was 1958. New York Times is a letter from Seymour Harris, the chairman of the Economics Department at Harvard, saying, what in the hell is the world coming to? Complaining in the New York Times that a place, no place like Wisconsin can take somebody away from Harvard. they were really upset. They didn't think, they didn't want to lose him.
But why didn't they offer him more salary then?
When we made the offer?
Yeah.
I think he wouldn't have taken it. He'd made up his mind. Guy was the kind of person, you know, that once, he wasn't playing with us to get a...
No.
No, counteroffer. And so they probably knew that. Why didn't they promote him a year earlier?
Well, no, presumably they have their ways of doing
things. Yes,
no,
right.
I was just wondering if they realized how valuable he was. But so you were able to promise him confidently that he would have, because he needed a great many. I mean, he needed computer.
We're going to use $100,000 from Wharf, and then we're going to go to Ford, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, Gordon Orchard got the money for that wing on social science.
Yeah,
he was very, you know, I didn't realize how persuasive he was, but he had great standing, you see. And he had enough confidence in himself that with that $100,000 he could get this other money, and we did get a lot of money. And then we had, so things moved very, this was very exciting times. I was operating all over the place.
But then when he came and he got the money and he got the Ford grant and set up the Social Systems Research Institute. Mm-hmm. But then, so what happened?
Well, this is... Why did it happen? Guy had this dream of this great scheme of a real model of the United States economy. Very difficult. I thought it was only a very small chance of ever pulling it off. I never thought he would. But the man was so good, you see, and the pieces that he needed to put it together were so valuable that even if you never got it all together, you know, it isn't like a house. lots of pieces would stand alone.
Use them, yes.
It's more like a condominium. If you don't get one roof on some part of it, you can still get quite a lot of building. And you see, I'm not a. I don't understand a lot of the stuff, but I understand a little bit about the pieces. And so,
by pieces, you mean people and
yeah, to do certain parts of it, like the people particularly.
Yeah.
The part. Now, Arnold Zellner was brought here.
Mm-hmm.
Very brilliant. He left us to go to Chicago. He told me primarily because Chicago promised that they would send this, pay the tuition for his five sons to go to Harvard if they could get in or any other place.
Wow. That's quite an incident, isn't it?
Yes, he had five boys.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, Chicago's a great place. He brought, Roger Miller was brought with Pete's suggestion. Charlie Holt came, wasn't the greatest in the world, but...
he wasn't. You didn't think so highly of him. I mean, there seems to be...
I liked him as a person, but he came to really help Guy.
But would he have been a reason why the thing didn't work?
No. It didn't work, I think. Now, this is my view, and you ought to check this, because these are highly subjective things. Because when you got Zellner here, and you got these various people, they got interested in their own things and moved away from the model. You see, there's no controlling them. It isn't like a group of graduate students or research associates where you assign things to them.
Yeah.
They get... But Guy... Well,
somebody said he'd worked on the Manhattan Project, and he was used to being able to control the research of people under him.
And this is, I think, the thing that fell apart. He didn't understand that these people, these very good people who brought here and came because they were excited about it.
Yeah.
One other just mention. Well, while this was going on, I think it was 57 or 58, the Economics Association meeting was in Philadelphia. And we had tried a couple of years before to get Bob Lampman to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Lampman, the phone rang. I was in bed, middle of the night. And Bob said, Ed... I've been at the meetings, and all the excitement's about Wisconsin. Sounds like it's going to a great place. I want to come. I said, Bob, you've got a position with tenure. No vote, nothing. The only time I ever offered a tenure position without going to get clearance.
I can see in this case you were safe.
Well, yeah, but you know, in the morning I thought, my God, what did you do in the night?
Yeah.
You know, if anybody ever finds out that you offered a position without...
You know what he said? He said, I think I was probably brought here to replace Bronfenbrenner.
Who?
I think Bob Lampman said that. I mean, he treated it very casually.
Yeah. Well, he was brought here because it was Bob Lampman. He was the best. He's about the best thing going. He's still in his business.
Huh.
Yeah, he's good. He's very good. His work is uniformly good if you read his stuff. It was a tremendously exciting time. And I wasn't the architect of all this, you understand. The ideas didn't come from me necessarily. The ideas came from this group as we grow
Steiner
and expand. It's Steiner, Early, Summers, Ellsworth, people who wanted the department to succeed, even though the work was not in the field that they weren't in, but they...
Yeah. I'm just looking through the
Summers
names
wasn't very important in the econometric side of it at that stage.
I see.
No.
What about Dave Johnson? Was he...
Dave was on the labor side. He was brought here was it replace Tripp? Did he come before Tripp left? Maybe...
No, he's before Tripp left.
Yeah, it was in prospect of taking place of Brandeis then.
Ah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Watts and Martin David were coming around 60,
yes,
62.
Watts was again attracted by the caliber of the people that had come before him, you see.
Mm-hmm.
By 62, you see, I was out of it.
And Goldberger.
Yes.
I understand was the star.
Yes, and he still is.
Acquisition. And did he come because of Orchid?
I think so, yes. What year did he come?
I have probably 61 or
yes, with Orchid and Steiner. and other people were persuasive, but Goldberger just absolutely tops. It's what very nice people they all are, with the exception of Walter, as individuals, you know. And it was really fascinating.
Now, do you say this from your later experience as dean and chancellor, that not all departments were as lucky? I mean,
yes,
is it
yes.
in that context yes, that yes. you say that?
Yes. When I see many departments have very, outside of, once the Martin issue was settled, we had a very congenial group of people. Now, as it got bigger and bigger, there tend to be some splits in its interest, but as individuals, they're just such nice people. But, you know, there isn't one of them over there that I don't really like quite well. Mm-hmm. I've chose to be here because I don't want to get mixed up in the little business. I'm lazy.
And how much did you, what contact did you have with the department after 1961?
Very little, except I'd known so many of them, and I, as a dean, of course, I had to deal with the chairman of the department.
Mm-hmm.
And but always invited to social affairs, and I still am, of course.
So, but to bring the Orcutt story,
mm-hmm.
was it just that?
That he left?
I mean for instance, I guess at about 1964, Ford wouldn't give him any more money.
Mm.
And I think that's about the time.
Mm-hmm. And I think he was discouraged.
Is it that he was a genius who couldn't understand how the little things worked? Is that the way you put it? Or?
I don't know that you say he was a genius. He wasn't in. He had this particular dream, and he was very good at it.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of people, some other people were just as good around the country. More single-minded than some of the others. I don't know. He's also an idealist.
Mm-hmm.
And this urban thing in Washington, I think, appealed to him is to get on with that too. Something, and it got him out of a situation that wasn't working out too. See, he'd gotten himself so committed. But see, by that time, I didn't see a lot of him. We saw him socially, but we were real good friends. And you know, his wife was this marvelous woman. She's in this, now is, I think, elected her second or third term in the Connecticut legislature.
Huh.
Yeah. We used to go out. They had some land out in the country, and we used to go out there sometimes and do things with them. But I'm not sure. See, by the time he left, I wasn't seeing very much of him. I was busy deaning.
But you were on the advisory committee of the Social Systems Research Institute.
Oh, my name was on there.
Oh, I see. You didn't have much to do with it.
No. Once I became dean, I pulled away from the department.
Yeah.
There was always the danger I'd be charged with getting.
But it was supposed to be interdisciplinary.
Oh yes,
I mean it was something
know, but,
like.
But
AMRC.
You know, I wasn't really. I hoped it would work, but it didn't. You see, I didn't have that craving for this one model. What I wanted from Orcutt was the kind of people that he would attract to his dream, and I would let them do their thing. But I wouldn't. I didn't want to tell him how to do it.
Hmm.
I wasn't interested in telling him how to do it. I didn't know enough.
Did he teach?
Yes.
And was he a good teacher?
Oh, I think he was a little difficult for the undergraduates to follow. The very good ones he was a good teacher for. I don't think he was the greatest teacher. He was not like Steiner, for instance. Hmm. He was extraordinarily good.
How about with graduate students?
I don't know. That would be a nice question. You better ask somebody else, because I don't recall how he was with them. He was a planner. He liked reorganizing things, and he had a lot of influence and reorganized the elementary course in a way that didn't work out very well.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very attractive, very persuasive person, a man that anybody would trust, you know.
Would you say he was a
and,
a child in a way in relation to university politics? And
oh, I don't think so. No. No, I don't think so. He wasn't that naive. I didn't regard him as terribly naive. It's, you know, everybody who comes here, we have a different system. You have to explain it to them how this place mm-hmm. works and every other place. So, no, I just thought he pushed for this thing, but he also was interested in, very much interested in undergraduate teaching. A little bit like Martin David. Martin, for a while, was interested in that. And Hansen, who, you know, wants to reorganize things and plan things, sees this picture of how everything in an orderly way. And I'm a very disorderly person, you see. Oh. So I was always amused by all this orderliness.
You're saying both Martin David and Lee Hansen were orderly, or just Lee Hansen?
Lee Hansen particularly.
David was very concerned. I mean, wrote memos to the department.
Yes, Martin has always had some of that. Martin is not as successful at it as Lee. Lee works at it. You know, Lee is really quite a marvelous person. He wasn't a very good teacher.
I'm going to be interviewing him.
And he took this seriously. Mm-hmm. And set about becoming a good one, and he did. He's a prime example of, if somebody makes up their mind to change their ways in teaching, they can. Mm-hmm. And Lee Hansen did it. The first thing he did when he became chairman of the department was issued a 20-page bulletin on how to find the paper clips and everything else. Well, it was very useful. Nobody'd ever bought. You just had to find out the hard way. Oh, I think very well of Lee, he's a little more serious than I am, I think. I don't take some things. But they needed somebody to neaten up the place after I left. But we were going off in all directions. At the same time, we were doing all this. I was starting this overseas business.
That's right. Well, statistics was a thorn in your flesh and had been 20 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What about it?
Well, we finally got it worked out because of changes with Pete here, who was a first-class statistician, and then when George Box came to the statistics department. See, the trouble with statistics before was in the math department.
Uh-huh.
You never have statistics in the math department. All those guys want to teach is mathematics. Because, see, people in a discipline, they don't play to the students. Most of them play to their colleagues.
Oh, yeah.
It takes a strong person to be independent of what, you have to be, have some sense of self-security to do your own thing.
Mm.
And most people don't. They, Jim Early, of whom I was very fond, Jim used to put out a bibliography about that thick for his course in the history of economic thought. There was no way, it was page after page, no way anybody could ever read that stuff. So most people didn't read any of it, but it was very impressive document circulating. I don't know if Jim did it for that reason, but some people do that kind of thing, you know.
Mm.
Or they talk about their standards, or about the big assignments they give, or there's various ways. But the mathematicians, and it isn't, weren't most of them, when they taught statistics, really weren't interested in teaching people to view statistics. They were interested in teaching them mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think Mark Ingram may have been an exception. He was a statistician, applied economist, applied mathematician. But then George Box came and was really interested in statistics. So that
did
made.
Did you have something to do with getting it here?
I can't remember. I can't remember the date. If I were dean, I did.
It would have been the 1960s sometime.
Yes, I think probably I did, as dean, you know. But you see, a dean can be helpful, but he doesn't make initiatives. See, so you can help find the money or persuade the person, or so on.
So you, but this getting, I thought it was business, commerce that was fighting for statistics. Like they were earlier.
Oh, they, Gomnitz taught statistics, you know, and they taught it for us, you know, that's before Steiner uh-huh. came. And they wanted, but they didn't want the math statistics either. So we preferred to have our students go to commerce, but some of our people didn't think it was the best statistics in the world. So, you know, every different group had a different view. For some, statistics was just a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For others, it's a useful tool. And for the mathematicians, it was mathematics.
Yeah.
So you got, Gomez taught statistics to undergraduates for a long time for economics. And Phil Fox, I took my graduate course with Phil Fox, a philosopher, was in the business school. Mm-hmm. Bill had his degree in philosophy. Oh, he taught me to have great to suspicion of statistics. I remember when I got my paper back, I had an A, got an A in the course. Phil saying, he said, well, Ed, you know, see, I'd never taken an undergraduate course in statistics. I started with a graduate course. Mm-hmm. And I had to work pretty hard. Reading the undergraduate book with one hand and working on the other with the other. He said, now, don't let this go to your head. He said, there's a lot you don't know yet. Which was absolutely true. But he was, Phil was a great person. But later, you know, in his old, after he retired, he became a very embittered old man. He was quite wealthy. But he wouldn't go anywhere, wouldn't travel. He died a year or two ago. Very tragic thing, you know.
I won't pursue why philosophers should be teaching a business course. But
well, I don't know how he got into it. Well, he and a man named Fox, and a man named, what was the other fellow's name? The philosopher's name? Fox? Oh, Sharp. We used to have a philosopher named Sharp here. Built the house that Emily Early lives in. And they, Fox and Sharp, wrote a textbook in business ethics. Wonderful. Title of authors to have a book. maybe he got in it that way. I don't know how he got into it, if Phil got into it, but he was maybe because he was a statistician as well as a philosopher.
But did you set up the Department of Statistics then to solve this? Was that it?
I don't know how. I can't remember much about
right.
that. I remember the problem, but it wasn't
it's
one.
It's just that somebody said of you that one of the problems of getting ORCID here was that you were suddenly this whole thing about statistics came up again, and you had to solve it.
Yeah, well, we solved it.
Yeah.
But it's been festering for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were doing so many different things at that time. It's hard to remember what you were doing. See,
yeah.
Most of my life's that, you know, I just keep jumping from one ice cake to the next.